This is CliffCentral.com. Property,
I'm trying to invest. Money in by the neighborhood, that's how you rinse it. I could have bought a place in Dumbo before it was Dumbo for like $2 million. That same building today is worth $25 million. Guess how I'm feeling? Dumbo.
It's time to buy back the block. Buy back the block. It's time to buy back the block. Buy back the block. Buy back the hood. I'm about to buy back the hood. Buy back the hood.
Good morning, everybody. How are you on this Wednesday morning? You are tuned into Living It Up with Lerato Shabala here on Cliff Central. Remember, you can get the podcast. It's live from 10 until 11 every Wednesday, but you can get it anytime, anywhere, no matter where you are in the world. I've been so lucky. I have people from all over the world listening to us, whether you're in New York, or Lagos, Nigeria. It's cliffcentral.com. And I want to remind you that this podcast is brought to you by Rally Mambewule Properties. You can go to rally-mambewule.co.za to learn more about the man himself. In fact, he will be here with me next week chatting about the Rally Mambewule National Learnership, his initiative to help people who want to get into the industry. So a couple of days ago, I got a text message from Sanele Kumalo 80 on Twitter, who said to me he wants to know more about building houses, and we need to get somebody in the studio. And because what I do is make sure that I speak to what you need to, I got on the phone and then I got some people, and today's show is going to be highly, highly informative. Remember, you can also follow us on our Facebook page for the show. It's Living It Up with Lerato Shabala on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter and on Instagram. It's at Lerato TJ. I have the National Technical and Inspector Manager for the National Home Builders Registration Council, or for short, the NHBRC, Mr. Fred Wagenaar. Morning, Fred. How are you?
Morning, Lerato. I'm well, thank you.
It is so lovely to have you here. We've already been chatting offline before we started about the essence of the show and why we wanted you here. And this is the first time we're actually speaking to any kind of building society, anything that has to do with building. This is our first show on that. We've had interior decorators, we've had designers, we've had banks and all these people, but this is the first time we're really digging deep, and I'm grateful for Sanele for suggesting this, because I think it happens a lot. So what I wanted to do, Fred, was basically start from what you'd call a very elementary level, okay, before we get into the mistakes that people make around building. When I was on your website looking through earlier, I saw that one of the first things you mention is that before a homeowner builds, they need to ask the home builder for their current registration certificate. Now, for me as a consumer, somebody who doesn't know, what does the registration certificate help with? What does it say to me? Why do I need to know that the builder has this?
Thank you, Lerato. You need to know that the builder has technical competence, he's got the financial acumen, and he's got project management skills. And that is part of the requirements that the NHBRC have to verify in terms of Act 95 of 1998, which is the Housing Consumer Protection Measures Act. Mm. So firstly, it is a statutory requirement that where a builder builds a house, that he'd be registered with the NHBRC and that he enrolls. And then the process of NHBRC vetting that the builder does have the technical competence, does have the financial acumen, and does have the project management skills to complete a project is very important to the consumer.
Mm. So when you speak about project management, what are you talking about directly for somebody who doesn't know?
Project management skills will entail being able to tackle a project from the beginning to the end.
Mm.
It entails managing scope, managing time, managing cost, managing human resources. That is the main four components that you would ultimately have in a project management scenario.
So making sure that the people are there on time, on site when they need to, making sure that you're running within budget, obviously.
Absolutely.
That type of thing. So I wanted to check something with you. When you say that a builder is registered, why is that important for me as a consumer, as a homeowner, as a somebody who's going to build my own home?
Firstly, as I said, is that NHBRC have vetted the builder, and secondly, it provides you with a warranty. So the builder has to be registered, he has to enroll the property with NHBRC. Where there is a roof leak or major structural distress, you would have access to the warranty that the NHBRC provides. If the builder is unable or unwilling to come to the party, NHBRC would then source an builder to come and fix the roof leak or the major structural distress items that have been identified on the house. So it's absolutely beneficial to the consumer.
So if I am looking for a builder, just to start with, would I start with the NHBRC or would I start anywhere if I'm looking for somebody to build from? And later on, we'll get into sectional titles, building for sectional titles and standalone homes. But what is the best way to look for a builder? Especially if you've never, like somebody like me, I've only bought structures that are already up and running. So I have no experience. I'm asking this for myself and for others. Where do you start in terms of looking for a builder? Because obviously somebody who's registered with NHBRC is much better. But where does a consumer start?
NHBRC have a website where we have home builders. Ultimately, just looking at the website will give you a builder that is registered. Normally, it's better to find somebody with a track record, somebody have used before, that is registered with the NHBRC, but they have successfully completed the project for that person.
Mm.
Ultimately, going onto the website, you'll find the builder, you'll find that he is registered, but that would not necessarily tell you that he has done that type of job, whether it's going to be a subsidy house, whether it's going to be a multi-story building or going to be a freestanding house, as you've said. So I put high value to track record, to proven competence in the industry where he says he's competent. So NHBRC registration important, but also to check that he has a track record in terms of what he says he can do.
So the website that Fred is talking about is www.nhbrc.org.za that you can go to find the builders. In fact, the point that you're making, the fourth point that I saw on your website, is about asking the builder to show you homes that they have done before. Now, for many people, this is awkward because they're like, because they're thinking, I should trust them, and this person's saying to me they've built whatever home. How would you suggest that do you see one home? Do you see two homes or buildings or whatever the person has made? How many would you suggest a person goes to see in order to be able to check the builder's competency, as it were?
I would definitely say more than one. Because ultimately, if you ask the builder, show me the houses that you've done, he's going to take you
show
to
you the
best.
Exactly.
So to look at more than one, and also to talk to the people, because it's not only about the finished product that you see with the eye, it's also the interaction that you had with the contractor. Conflicts arise during construction. How was this conflict resolved? Amicably? Or was there a problem after they left that the guy said, I will never have this builder back on site?
Mm.
So it is important that you interact with people. I mean, we live in a society where people will tell you, they'll promise you the sun, moon and stars. And you know that...
And they'll leave you hanging. And then you are in a dispute. I'm in a separate dispute over a custom piece of furniture that I wanted made. And it has been 2.5 months, in fact, almost 3 now, since I ordered this furniture, and it has not arrived. And one of the things I realized was, even though I got an invoice, and now we're going to get into technical parts about the contract, it's important to have a contract with whoever is building your home. It is not enough to think, oh, here's Fred, he's really nice. He said he's, you know, he's built all these wonderful places and he's going to, you know, make me a nice house. And then I just trust him based on that. In terms of a contract, how is that drawn up between the two of you? Is that something that your builder would then bring to you? And what should you be looking out for in the contract when you're signing it to build your home?
Yeah, Lerato, that is a major area of content. Firstly, you're right. The handshake and the smile is not a contract anymore. So what you'd have to do is ultimately the builder is going to try and write a contract that would
suit them. Absolutely. Suit them. Because, I mean, who wouldn't? Who wouldn't? No matter who you are, no matter what it is, if you can skew something towards your benefit, you will.
Absolutely. And therefore, there is contracts in the industry, the JBCC, the FIDIC, the NEC, the GEC. It's standard contracts that's available in the industry and that is balanced in terms of both service provider and consumer. Mm-hmm. To ensure that all the aspects in terms of contracting is covered. Things like performance. Okay. If the guy does not perform within a time frame, that there's penalties applicable. Provision that if there's escalation material, that those can be entered into the contract. Provision that the guy is only paid for what he has done. Because I find that is a major bone of contention. People paying for work that have not been completed. They end up with a house that is incomplete, but they have expended all their monies. And then try and run around to find out, but what can I do? And I have to tell you, builders, a lot of builders in the industry, if they have finished the project, finished the money, and the project is not finished, they do not have the financial acumen to go back and finish that project. Mm. So if they want to go back, they'll have to take it from the next project. So it's a knock-on effect.
Jeez, it's like when people have a credit card and they're paying one credit card with another credit card.
That's exactly it. So one, contract well, manage your finances well, and manage your builder in terms of your contract. And he can manage you in terms of your contract as well. I mean, we also have complaints from that come to the NHBRC in regards to consumers that do not want to pay the builder.
Mm.
So there's two sides of the story. There's never just one side of the story. But I think if you have a good contract, you're able to manage your relationship. You're able to manage the contract against set performance parameters that is specified in the contract.
So one of my favorite shows to watch, Fred, is Grand Designs, an architectural show. And I like the British version. And one of the things they always say is that if your builder says the budget is 250, you double it. So is that like a standard thing? So because when you're writing the contract and the person says it's going to be 500K and then they come back and then they say they have found this and then they have found that and there's a pipe that goes through the thing. So in terms of situations like that, I mean, what kind of advice would you have for people who are building a home?
My advice would be involve the professionals. If you involve a quantity surveyor, for instance, you will have a defined cost for the project. Within your contract, you'll also provide for things that can go wrong, additional items that might be preferenced by the consumer that he wants to put in, and therefore you can apply site instructions.
Mm.
At the end of the day, the quantity surveyor can quantify the site instructions that were approved by yourself, and then it's a fair dispensation in terms of payment for what you got. If you do not have that, you're unable to control your expenditure. It's also great to have a professional involved when you have to meet payment stages.
Mm.
To say, but at this stage, I'm only going to pay you X because this is what we have.
You read my mind, because that was going to be my next question when you were talking about the contract, which is how do I then stagger the payments? Because some people think, oh, it's in good faith to show the person that I value them, so I'm going to pay them and give them the money as opposed to, you know, holding back. And then some other people then think, no, I can only do 50%. Is that something that you put down in the contract to say, at the beginning, this is what I'll pay for? Because you do need to release some funds in, you know, for material, but that you can't necessarily give everything because, as you say, you'll end up running after somebody who can't finish the house or pay you back.
No, true. In terms of NHBRC, builders that are registered with the NHBRC are not allowed to ask for a deposit before they start building, because that's where the biggest problem starts. They ask for a deposit and they never come back to site. They order the material, some of the material is delivered on site, and then they just disappear. So registered builders, in terms of our code of conduct, are not allowed to ask for a deposit.
I did not know that.
If you are in the industry, you should have a credit facility, a 60-day facility with your supplier, or you should have the cash to be able to carry yourself until the first draws. In terms of draws, in the contract you will specify at what stages payment will be made. The problem is that you must verify that that payment stage have been reached when you make the payment, so that you don't overpay. There's also a provision for retention that is retained on every payment stage. 10% retention is retained, so that at the end of the day, after the 90-day defect liability period and all small patent and latent defects have been sorted out, that you can then release your retention money, which is the final closure of the contract.
Ah, so I want to just to reiterate this, and if you've just tuned in, you are tuned into Cliff Central, you're listening to Living It Up with me, Lerato Shabalala. I'm talking to the National Technical and Inspection Manager at the NHBRC, Mr. Fred Wagenaar, and we're talking everything around building your home. Remember, this podcast is brought to you by Riley Mampuelo Properties. You can go to Riley-Mampuelo.co.za to learn more. Please understand what Fred said. A builder who is registered with an accredited body like the NHBRC does not ask for a deposit, because the assumption is that he has the funds as a running, healthy business to fund the first stages of building your home. I think we need to drive that point, because a lot of people, I suspect, do not know this. I think a lot of people are not aware of this. And I think it's something that we need to specify and just stick to, so that you remember it when you're sitting and you're looking at your contract. In terms of contracts, will they also specify a certain thing as how long the project is going to take?
Yes.
And are there variables in terms of how long it will take?
The contract, in terms of your contract, you are going to specify a contract period.
Okay.
And the contract period would ultimately also be tied up to penalties. If the guy do not complete in time, you're going to have expenses, because you have to be out of your house in 3 months, the current house.
Mm.
You want to move in 3 months, you cannot move in. Now you have to pay for additional, you have to pay for rental somewhere else so that you can accommodate him. And that is the sort of penalties that's normally applicable when a guy do not finish on time. So yes, within the contract, there is a specified time frame. When do you start? When do you finish? In terms of the second question, in relation to, is there things that can affect? Yes, there is things like vis majeure, acts of God.
Yes, floods.
Yeah, that you cannot contend with, and therefore you can then apply for extension of time. The contractor can then, in terms of the contract, apply for extension of times, which will be condoned based on the proven facts that excessive weather conditions, so much raining that the contractors could not move on site, whatever the case might be.
Yeah.
So yes, there is provision in the contract.
I wanted to go back to a point. I wanted to ask you, what, in the easiest way that you can explain, does a quantity surveyor do? Because you mentioned that, you know, you'd want to involve a quantity surveyor. And I think, I know people listening are going to think, oh, so many terms. And so my job is to take what Fred knows and package it for you in such a way that you understand what it is that you'll need to know when you're building your home.
A quantity surveyor would normally look at the architects and engineering details for the project.
Ah.
And he would then go and he would quantify, specify the material, and quantify the material that has to be used. So it's the material specification, the quantification, and then the costing element that he adds to it. So that costing element ultimately becomes your budget. Tells you what it's going to cost, because that ultimately includes all your elements, your construction elements, as well as your preliminaries in general, your plant in general, the things that happen before the guy move on to site, the provision for toilet facilities, etc., etc. Finishing with the ultimate end product where the retention is released. The quantity surveyor is also the person that, in terms of progress, would sign a certificate to say this is the amount of work that have been done to date and which you can pay for.
Okay, this is really interesting for me, because I did not know this. Because basically, they are the person who will be able to say, because remember, home owners, and I know this for all of us, it is such an emotional experience. It is such an experience that you really have dreams about this home. You imagine what it's going to look like. And so a quantity surveyor is the person who's going to make sure that you get what you want, when you want it, within the budget that you want it to be in. And I think that sometimes when you hear certain things, you think, oh, no, I don't want to pay this person. I can get one person to do everything. Every step that you skip in such an intense thing as building your home has huge ramifications, both emotionally for you, both financially, and obviously in terms of you being able to move into your house, as Fred said. So now that you know that a quantity surveyor is needed, do not cut corners. I want to drive this to the people listening right now to this podcast. You cannot cut corners. We've seen buildings, Fred, where they are cracking, where they are lopsided, and it is because you did not do the simple things, as you said, to go and see what homes the other person has built, more than just one. Go look at that. Ask the people who've lived there. It's also nice to walk around and say, how long did it take? You know, those are essential questions to ask. You cannot skip a step, am I right? You cannot take somebody out of the equation that is needed to build you your home.
Lerato, you are so right. You know, we've spoken about the role of the quantity surveyor, but the role of the architect is also important.
Mm.
Because a lot of people think that, you know, they're prepared to pay 7 to 10% for estate agents when they buy a secondary dwelling, but they're not prepared to pay an architect to design and oversee the project for you, especially if you are not technically competent to oversee the project. You can appoint your architect as the principal agent that will then overlook the work to ensure that there is full compliance with the specification, whether by the engineer or the architect himself. The architect would ultimately also be able to ensure that you comply with the local building law, the National Building Regulations and Standards Act, Act 103 of 1977, which specifically specify that you have to look at the soil conditions. The soil conditions is going to determine the foundation solution. The foundation solution is ultimately going to play a huge role in terms of future performance of the structure.
Mm.
We spoke about cracks. If you do not have the right soil classification, you put in the wrong foundations, you can never fix the foundations. You can, a crack in the wall, which is not related to the foundations, you can fix. You can fix the roof. You can fix plaster cracks. But a foundation, you'd have to demolish the house to redo it. So a foundation is cardinal to the whole process. And using a professional to ensure that you have followed all the steps will ultimately, I mean, the house is your biggest asset that you're going to own in your life. So you do not want to take a shortcut anywhere where even the design, you know, a shoebox design might not have the same value as a design that is ultimately more aesthetically pleasing. In terms of when you sell the product, it is, you spoke about the programs where you look at the architectural features built into these houses. That immediately appeals to the buyer. Mm-hmm. So when you want to sell, you have a product that is structurally sound, you have a product that is aesthetically pleasing, and as a consumer, you will only benefit by it.
I think you mentioned such an important thing about, it's not just about the aesthetics. As I said to you, we've had interior designers on the show. We've had all kinds of people and that are about the beauty of the house, but the structure of the house and the foundation. And that's why I think for me, when people say we're building a foundation, it's an important thing, because whether that foundation is in a business or you as a human being in terms of what you want to do for your life, that foundation, whether that is an education for yourself, is the same thing as for a house, because it is the starting point. It is the part, I always say, the thing about foundation is that it's the part of the house that nobody ever sees, but it's the most important part of the house. So you cannot skip a step.
You cannot
skip a step. So we spoke about, you were talking about some of the defaults and defects in the house. You were also talking, I was actually looking at your website again, and you spoke about they speak about, the NHBRC talks about a snag list, that there's a 3-month, it says here that the NHBRC deals with three types of complaints: the 3-month snag list, a 1-year roof leak, and a 5-year major structural defect. I thought that perhaps you could take us through that for ease of understanding.
Oh, great, yeah. The 90-day defect liability that we refer to is that 3 months. After you've taken occupation of your house, you start compiling a list of things that you see. It could be patent, meaning visible by the eye.
Okay.
It's a light fitting that doesn't work. It's a door that's catching when you close the door. It's a tap that's leaking. Things that you a door that was not painted, a wall that was not properly painted, a ceiling that was not properly fixed. And you start making a list of all these small things. And what you do is, remember we spoke about retention. So every payment you do, you retain 10% of the retention,
okay,
as retention. That is ultimately a kitty of money that is left over. And that is the carrot that brings the builder back to finish all defects that you have. So after the 90-day defect liability period, you hand him the snag list. He comes, he fixes the snag list. You sign off on the snag list, and then you are able to instruct your quantity surveyor to release the final retention. So in terms of your 90-day defect liability period, it's something that's managed within the contract with the builder. It's managed by yourself because you retain the purse. So please do not make payment if you are not satisfied. Get to be satisfied before you release final payment.
Important this, which means that even if you have the nicest builder and they say, listen, Lerato, just pay me this and I guarantee you. You say, you know what, I like you so much for it, but let's fix it first and then I'll pay you.
I like what you're saying, yeah. And then we look at the 12-month roof leak period. That's a common law requirement. And what has to happen within the first 12 months of moving into the house, it's normally 2 rainy seasons. If you have any roof leaks, the builder has to come back and fix.
Okay.
If the builder does not come back and fix the roof leak within that period, he can either be insolvent, run away, gone overseas, whatever the case might be. You'd have a claim against the warranty fund.
Okay.
So in terms of your 90-day defect liability period, you manage that. So therefore, there is no claim against the NHBRC. We would accept a complaint. We will deal with a complaint, but there is no warranty on the 90-day defect liability period. There is a warranty on the 12-month roof leak period.
Okay.
If there is a roof leak and the builder is not available, NHBRC would have to go back, appoint the builder, and fix the roof leak. In terms of major structural distress, which is the third item covered under Section 13 of the Act, is 13.2b, in fact, is major structural distress. Major structural distress is, for instance, where your foundation was underdesigned, where the wrong site soil classification were used. You look at cracks in excess of 5 to 15 millimeter. You look at cracks that open up. You look at serious demolishment and reconstruction work that have to happen. The builder registered with the NHBRC have the liability to go back and fix the major structural distress. Ultimately, again, if he's not available, the NHBRC will be available and the NHBRC will come in and will fix.
What I like about this, and I know particularly in a place like South Africa where a lot of the people, a huge part of the population is still learning about this, and a lot of people are inclined to go with somebody that they know, somebody that, you know, they feel like, oh, this person can do this for me. Or sometimes, you know, you buy land and the section of title people say, oh, go with our person. You still, as a person who is going to pay for the property, have every right to find out if the person has a certificate, to see what properties they've done, so that you're able to make an informed decision. Because all of it, to end up in such a situation where you have to now be in a dispute, is because you didn't have a checklist of things that you needed to say, okay, tick this is done, tick this is done, so that you're able to protect yourself. It's all about protecting yourself. And I think that your builder as well, both of you need to be protected by this, so that you are able to say, okay, at the end of this, who knows, you might build another home, you might know another friend and recommend that person, or have a really great relationship with that person. And I know people who are friends with their builders, you know, after that experience. So it doesn't have to be as painful as now being in a dispute. But once you've ticked all these boxes, you're good to go. I mean, that's the whole point.
You know, it's so important that you have to know that you have to look after yourself.
Yes.
As you've said.
Yeah.
Nobody is going to look after you if you do not have a good contract in place, which ultimately determines the relationship that you're going to have and the performance from both sides. It always ends up in conflict.
Mm.
From an NHBRC side of or perspective, we would like to have the builders being a friend of the consumer after he's completed the house.
Mm.
You said something earlier, the emotional impact. Mm. They say that if a marriage can outlast building a house, the marriage will last forever. Similarly, if you have a builder which is tied into a good contractual relationship,
yep,
he knows exactly what the boundaries is, you know what the boundaries is, you know that if you're asking for extras to be done, you're going to have to pay for it.
Exactly.
If the builder messes up and he has to redo, he knows that you are not going to pay for that.
Exactly.
Because that's part of the contract, and that's why it's so important to, as you say, have all the boxes ticked in the beginning. And remember, Fred might be known to Lerato as a good builder, but Lerato, when Sia comes through to contract with Fred, he must tick all the boxes that's important to him to ensure that Fred's going to deliver. Yeah.
Exactly. If you just tuned in, I'm speaking to the NHBRC's National Technical and Inspection Manager, Mr. Fred Wagenaar. You can download this podcast from 10 o'clock. We are live from 10 until 11 every Wednesday here on Cliff Central. You can also follow our Facebook page, our podcast Facebook page. It's Living It Up with Lerato Shabalala, where you can actually interact with us. Let us know what you think of the podcast, particularly this podcast. And I just want to remind you once again that this podcast is brought to you by Raleigh Mampewule Properties. You can go to raleigh-mampewule.co.za to learn more. Now, I wanted to ask you, Fred, what are, in your view, are the top three mistakes that first-time home builders, as it were, make when deciding to build their own home?
I think the first mistake is decide that financial constraints are going to determine where I am going to buy.
Mm.
First-time home builders, I would always recommend buy the plot in the right area, because it's not about only building the house, it's about schools, it's about accessibility, it's about distance to work. So decide firstly that the land that you're going to buy, that you want to develop, is in the right area.
Yes.
The second thing is involve professionals. The third thing that is important is this is an asset for life. Ensure that you treat it in that way, with the right respect, ensuring that you get what you pay for, and what you pay for is going to outlive your expectations, outlive your bond period. If you're looking at a bond period of 25 years, we know that you have to do maintenance. So acquaint yourself with what is required after you've taken occupation of the house, but the right location, mm-hmm, location. The second thing is that
involve the professionals, you said.
Involve the professionals, ensure that you get the aesthetic and professional input so that you can get a good quality end product. And then apply yourself in the circumstances where you have to take ownership of a property. In HBRC, we've seen a lot of people thinking that the builder remains liable forever. Fortunately, that's not true. As soon as the house is handed over, as soon as you've run out of your 12-month roof leak period, as soon as you have run out of your 5-year structural warranty, you have full liability of everything. Maintenance-related items that happen within that period, in any case, is for your account. So if you do not maintain your house, you cannot now go and say, but the builder, because there's a liability. We know that every 3 years you have to paint your house.
Yeah. So and you, if you have gutters around your house and there's a tree around it and the leaves get stuck in the gutters and then it ends up making your roof leak after 5 years or whatever, that is your problem.
Absolutely your problem.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, including sort of myself, when I first started with, you know, having a house, you just don't understand. You're like, I'm going to call this person and complain. Mm. And then the bank or whoever says, no, sissy, it's your issue. You must maintain your house. So it's also important to find out how it is you maintain your house. It's incredibly, like, it's so important. So just to drive Fred's points again, think of the location. Remember, as Fred said, this is a financial investment for your future. You cannot buy in an area that is not, buy or build in an area that is going nowhere. Ultimately, in order to make your return on investment, you need to think about, in 5 years' time, will there be schools in this area? Will there be shopping malls around this area? What about the transport system to get around there? Obviously, it depends on which time of your life you're in. I mean, you might want to build around a farm, and what you want is tranquility and you want silence. So it's all about your personal needs. As you said, making the example of me and Sia, no two homeowners are the same. So you must think of what's important to you, but location determines everything. If you want to be a city slicker, you need to make sure that you're in the right environment for that, but always think about your location. And also, as Fred said, don't let your financial constraints be the determining factor for where you are going to build your home. If you have, and we're going to talk about budgets, because I was also looking at the website in terms of houses that are over 500K and houses that are 400K and how the NHBRC deals with that. But we'll get to that in a second. But think of that. The second point is involve professionals. I keep saying this. I understand that everybody has a budget, that you want to build a home, that you want to be in there within 3 to 6 months, that you have all these dreams of what your place is going to look like. You're going to have skylights in the roof and all kinds of things. And you're going to have lights that are automatically operated. If you want all the gizmos and whatever, you need to get somebody who can do it. You need to get somebody who's going to make sure. Fred spoke about a quantity surveyor. The professionals, it's the same way as you would never let a truck driver fly a plane. Okay, so if the house is the same, in order in 15 years or 10 years when you want to sell the house and make money, you have got to use people who are qualified to do it. I'm going to say this over and over and over because I understand how we are as a nation. We want to help other people. We don't believe in contracts. Just make sure that you get the professionals. And also, the last point is to remember that this is an investment for you. You are building for your future. So make sure that all the money that you're putting in, that all the energy and the emotional struggle, and Fred was saying about a marriage lasting, is the same thing as having a builder, a relationship with your builder. So in terms of costings, I know the NHBRC looks very differently at houses that are over 500K and houses that are under. Could you take us through that for a second, Fred?
Currently at the NHBRC, we have two scenarios. We look at the subsidy product, okay, and ultimately that's where government plays a major role, whether it's financially linked individual subsidies, whether it's CRU, community, residential units, whatever. Government has got a number of subsidy programs. Mm. And then we have non-subsidy. We've divided it between subsidy and non-subsidy.
Okay.
So if you look at the non-subsidy side, it could be any value. It's normally a bonded house or it's a house paid for cash, but where there is no subsidy money involved. In terms of NHBRC, the enrollment value of the house is the value that you have bought the land and the construction cost of the project. You have to enroll the house for that value to NHBRC.
Right.
The value of that is, if it's 400,000 rand, you have to add 1.3% to that because that is the value that you ultimately pay in terms of your warranty. If you, the maximum amount that you would pay is 34,000 rand in terms,
okay,
of the warranty. Now, if you have a house that is, in terms of redress from the consumer to the NHBRC, if you have a structural complaint, the maximum amount that would be paid out would be the enrollment value. If it's 200,000, the house and the land was 200,000, that is the maximum amount that would be paid out. And would ultimately the 200,000 would be equated to the 1.3%. If you ever have a house that is 5 million rands, you're going to pay 34,000 rands and you'll only be able to claim up to 500,000. But now you have to realize that you've got 34,000 rand, which provides you for a warranty for 5 years and provides you to access a 500,000 rands. There's no other insurance product. that could match that.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So the value is inherent and built into the end product that we deliver, the warranty that is available to the consumer.
Jeez, I mean, that is something I totally didn't know. And I think it's great for consumers to know that bodies like the NHBRC are built to help you to make sure, because, you know, I think it's been about 30 years.
The NHBRC started in 1994, 1995.
Yeah, so about when
the new democratic dispensation. So, yeah, it's been going for a number of years.
Yes.
And firstly, it was started as an industry body for industry, by industry for industry. Then ultimately, we had resistance from major players in the industry. And Willie Cobbett, at the time, who was DG at the Department of Housing, it then Housing became Human Settlements, said, guys, if you don't play by the rules, I'll legislate. And in 1996, 97, we started drafting the legislation. And the Act came to be in 1998, Act 95 of 1998, the Housing Consumer Protection Measures Act, which ultimately then provides that it's now a statutory requirement for builders to register and to enroll. I can also mention at this stage that banks and conveyancers, or financial institutions and conveyancers, are also mentioned in the Act. So it would be a transgression of the Act if a financial institution would provide mortgage finance to on a house that is not built by a registered builder that is not enrolled. Similarly, a conveyancer cannot transfer a property when the property is not registered, the builder is not registered, and the property is not enrolled with the NHBRC.
See, all this is really interesting to me. I wanted to find out, Fred, are there particular documents that you need to have before you start building? Are there certain things that you need to go, and where do you go for to attain certain documents before you can start any kind of building?
Normally, before you start building, as a consumer, you would ultimately have to know where you're going to build, what the standards, you have to know what the geotechnical conditions is going to be. You need to identify the builder, you need to identify your professional team, and normally they will take you through the process, because there is a process of plan approval. We've got Act 95 of 1998, which is the Housing Consumer Protection Measures Act, and then we've got Act 103 of 1977, which is the National Norms and Standards Act in terms of building. So thereby, you have to go to the local authority, you have to submit a plan, the plan have to be approved. But if you involve the professionals, you as a consumer will not have the headache to draw up a plan, to draw up a specification, to go to the municipality and submit. You can make that as part of the professional appointment, or for instance your architect to do that. So yeah, there's a lot of work to be done, there's a lot of paperwork, but if you involve the professional team, it takes off all the pressure of yourself. Very important as a consumer, as you said right in the very, very beginning, Lerato, is make sure the builder is registered, make sure the builder is enrolled, make sure the builder has a sound track record in terms of the project that you're going to appoint him. Do not appoint a builder that have built subsidy houses to do a multi-story, 10-story block of flats.
Yeah, because it's beyond the capacity.
Check that he has the capacity. And I'm talking about technical capacity, financial capacity. You don't want to have him start the project and then declare that I cannot continue.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same as, I think that is such a good example to make. All of us are competent at something. I mean, I can twist my dreadlocks, but I can't style them. You know what I mean? Some people can shave beards, but they can't. So it's all about, it's not to say somebody can't do something, but if you're asking them to do something above the level that they are used to, there are obviously ramifications for you. We are not saying do not trust somebody that you believe in, but understand that if they are only used to building a certain kind of structure, there might be problems. I wanted to ask you, is there a difference when you are building within a sectional title, that is for people who are thinking, what is that, a townhouse situation, to a standalone? Is there a difference in terms of when you're building in that way, or is it all the same?
In terms of technical requirements, there is no difference in terms of technical requirements. Mostly it's management requirements. If you're building in a sectional title scheme, for instance, you'll have a body corporate or an oversight, and which will ultimately guide you in terms of aesthetic requirements that you have to be compliant to, which is totally different where you have a standalone, a house on a stand, where you have total ownership. You don't have to speak to anybody. There's no private and communal areas. When you go into a sectional title, you have private areas, you have communal areas, normally your swimming pool, your roads, etc., your parking areas might be allocated. So there's different things that you have to consider when you do sectional title. Sectional title also is now a clustered number of units within a development, development. And there is more things that become into play, like stormwater management. Because when you are one house on one stand, you can manage your own stormwater management. Now you're sitting in a sectional title where there's a house above you, and you have stormwater that comes from that house to your property that have to be managed. So it becomes more intricate in ensuring that the whole, where you only have one house on one stand, to make that house work, you know, more intricate in making all the houses work together in unison.
So I actually realized that one of the things that I needed to mention is that one of the reasons why you need to go and check with the municipality, depending where you're building. So for instance, there could be rules around the type of houses that can be built. It could be a situation where houses are not meant to be above particular stories because they'll block the view of other homeowners. Or it could be that you're building around a national site and there's certain structural things you can't do. For instance, I have a friend who's got a house in the CBD in Joburg, and he could not change the bay windows of that particular building. He could do everything, he could do certain things inside, but in terms of how the building looked outside, he needed to keep it within the fashion, because that particular building is considered a national heritage site. So it's important to find out before you build, because you may end up transgressing. So it's not necessarily to make things difficult for you. It's just so that you don't find yourself having to pay for making a mistake that you could have avoided by asking first. So
I have to tell you, that's an excellent statement, because that's something that we haven't covered, is the town planning requirements.
Yes, yes.
So when you ultimately want to purchase land where you want to build, let them give you the township establishment conditions, the rules applicable to the township, which will guide you in terms of servitudes, building lines, coverage, if you are floor area ratios. It will tell you what you can build on that house. And then you also need to look at the title deeds, which is a separate document. The title deeds will ultimately inform you in terms of height, as you've said, in terms of can you go double story, can you not go double story, what your coverage is going to be, etc., etc., where there is a servitude, you cannot build over that servitude, what is the restrictions in terms of development on that stand. So the two things is your title deeds is very important, but it's also good to know what the township establishment conditions are, which is applicable to that specific site.
Because that will, as I said, that will help you ultimately in not wasting your time, wasting your money, making you stressed. Because if you don't involve the professionals and you want to do it yourself, you have to go in front of that body and make a case for whatever you want to do. And there's times when people have lost, where the municipality says, or the town planners are like, actually no, we gave you the title deed, you knew what you shouldn't do and you still did it anyway, so you have got to fix it. Which is why the more knowledge you have, the better things will be. I'm in the studio with the National Technical and Inspection Manager at the NHBRC, Mr. Fred Wagenaar. You will be able to download this podcast from 10 o'clock this morning on a Wednesday and listen to it wherever you are in the world. This is cliffcentral.com. My name is Lerato Shabala. Remember that you can follow us on follow me, actually, on Twitter and Instagram at Lerato TJ, and also become a Facebook friend for the Living It Up page on Facebook, so you can actually get involved and start talking to us more. In fact, today's topic was inspired by a listener, Sanele Kumal, who wanted us to talk about building a house. Now, I wanted to ask, as I wrap up, is there a difference between a contractor and a builder?
In terms of NHBRC, we have two defined categories, as a developer and a builder. A developer might not have the capacity to build by himself. But he's the guy that will buy out the land, put in the infrastructure, and then sell the stands off.
Okay.
And then if you want him to build for you, you just enter into a building contract with him. He will appoint a builder to do the work. So both the contractor and the builder have to be registered with the NHBRC. In the case where you contract with a developer rather or a developer contractor rather than a builder, both have to be registered. And the guy that will do the enrollment is the developer that have developed the land.
Oh, okay. So do you usually have to get both, or can you get one without the other?
You can get one without the other.
Okay.
If you contract directly with a builder, then the builder is going to build.
Okay.
But we have scenarios where we have bigger guys, bigger developers that are more specifically looking into buying land, developing the land, rather than getting involved in the physical construction itself.
Okay.
But if you contract with that guy to buy the land and it's a building contract, so you buy the land and you want him to build for you, he has to then contract with a registered builder to build. But the guy that ties and carries the liability is the developer, because he determines the specification, he signs the contract, he's tied into the contract with the consumer. So yes, in terms of NHBRC, we have made provision for registration of developers and builders. And in the case where you have a developer that is not in the norm of building, he has to enter into a separate contract with a builder, but he is the guy, the developer has to be the guy that has to be enrolled. We have seen in the history where developers have abused builders.
Yes, in fact, that's what I was about to get to, that I've seen a lot of cases, obviously watching architectural shows and learning about property, yeah, where the developers and the builder get into a dispute and the builder is changed after X amount of time. The project still continues, but it just means that that relationship has not worked out. Is it just because somebody's going to benefit more than the other? And maybe the builder's saying, look, you do need to do these changes, and the developer's looking at the money and the... Is it that kind of thing in terms of the abuse that you speak about?
It's a volatile relationship.
Yes.
The developer ultimately wants to make most money out of it.
Yep.
The builder does not want to concede. He also wants to make money out of it.
Yep.
So, it's a problematic relationship, and you will find. And that's why it's so important that the developer is the guy that enrolls. So if the builder leaves, he is still free to appoint anybody, because he takes full ownership, the developer, takes full ownership of what happens on site. So if Fred leaves, he can appoint Lerato to finish the project within the time, budget, scope, cost.
So my final question, and by the way, if you are listening now and you're thinking, you know, I want to get all this information, I'm going to sit down and write everything down, but where do I go? You can go to the NHBRC's website, which is www.nhbrc.org.za, or you can call their toll-free number, which is 0800-200-824. Okay, let me say that slowly. It is 0800-200-824, or go to www.nhbrc.org.za to actually get more info. So lastly, Fred, what once again, for people who sort of missed it, the top three or top five things that you need to consider first, or need to do, or have on your checklist before you choose a builder and start building your house?
It's very important that you know what your budget is going to be. It's important to have locality. Decide to buy in the right locality, because that's going to ultimately determine your asset value. Involve your professionals so that they can take care of it. Also, in terms of professionals, we have not mentioned at Lerato, but professionals have to be registered with their professional councils, whether it's architects, engineers, quantity surveyors, town planners. They also carry professional indemnity insurance.
Mm.
So where they are negligent, you're able to claim against their professional indemnity insurance. So involve the professionals. Fourthly, ensure that the product that is going to be delivered is in accordance with the contract that you've entered into with the builder. Mm. Do not accept inferior work just because I need to move into the house. Ensure that you have an effective contract that covers all the loopholes, and that covers also penalties where the guy is not producing in accordance to the said contract. And lastly, remember that the property is an asset. Maintain it, keep it up, look after it. You want to sell it eventually and make some money out of it. That's what we want to do. That's why we have houses.
Thank you so much. That is Mr. Fred Wagenaar, the National Technical and Inspection Manager at the NHBRC. You have been listening to Living It Up with Lerato Shabalala here on Cliff Central. You can catch us next week as I speak to the man himself who sponsors the show, Mr. Ralima Mpewule, about the Ralima Mpewule learnership, helping people become real estate agents and be financially sound themselves. Thank you so much, Fred, for an incredible conversation, for being so helpful to so many of us. It has been great having you on the show.
Thank you, Lerato. It was great being here. And yes, I hope that I've inspired people.
Yes, you have. Yes. Yes, you have. And we look forward to having you again next time. Remember, follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, on it's at cliffcentral.com, or go to Facebook for the podcast's page, Living It Up with Lerato Shabalala, or follow me at Lerato TJ on Instagram and on Twitter. We will catch you again next week between 10 and 11. You can download the podcast anytime, anywhere, no matter where you are. This is Living It Up with Lerato Shabalala here on cliffcentral.com. Check you out next week. Bye, everybody.
Property, I'm trying to invest. Money in by the neighborhood, that's how you rent it. I could have bought a place in Dumbo before it was Dumbo for like $2 million. That same building today is worth $25 million. Guess how I'm feeling, Dumbo.
It's time to buy back the block. Buy back the block. It's time to buy back the block. Buy back the block. Buy back the hood. I'm about to buy back the hood. Buy back the hood.
This is CliffCentral.com.